to spend just a couple of minutes talking about Fortify Rights and what we do, just by way of setting a bit of backdrop for why I'm here and speaking. So Fortify Rights is a human rights organization based entirely in Southeast Asia. We work in Myanmar, Thailand, and Malaysia. I've been with Fortify Rights for the last couple of years. In that time, I've spent about 18 of those months working in Rakhine State on different issues in Rakhine. At the same time, I've spent a lot of time in Kachin and Northern Shan states to try and understand more about the conflicts in that part of the country, to understand some of the dynamics of those conflicts, and also to understand the situation for internally displaced populations or IDPs there. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. There are three things in particular that I'd like to talk about, namely the growing restrictions on humanitarian groups delivering assistance to IDP populations. I'd like to talk about the impacts those restrictions are having on IDPs. And I'd like to spend a moment talking about how Myanmar state security forces are targeting human rights defenders, journalists, and activists to try and keep what's happening in the north of Myanmar quiet. I should say that although that title is in IDPs in Kachin and Northern Shan states, the focus of my presentation will be Kachin. There are some elements of Northern Shan that are included, and if there's any interest, I'm happy to talk about the work that we've done in Northern Shan as well in a Q&A. Let me make sure this is going on. So, since 2011, as many of you know, successive governments in Myanmar have been working on a much vaunted, much celebrated peace process to bring about an end to the country's decades-long conflicts in Karen State, in Shan State, in Kachin, and others besides, in Mon. In October of 2015, this peace process brought about the nationwide ceasefire agreement, of which eight ethnic armed organizations signed on to. Many more did not sign on to that. And conflicts across Myanmar have continued. I think it's worth saying up front that while we recognize that NCA process was widely celebrated and seen as a milestone in Myanmar's hopeful move towards peace, there were several key ethnic armed groups that didn't sign on, namely the United Wa State Army and the Kachin Independence Army, along with several others. What we've seen is a peace process that has taken place largely in Naypyidaw and Yangon, while the conflicts in the north of the country have continued unabated. Across Northern Shan and Kachin State, we continue to see gross human rights violations being perpetrated against civilians and others besides. So in 2014, Fortify Rights weighed in on that based on research that we'd done from the beginning of the conflict, the most recent episode of conflict in Kachin State in June 2011, until 2014. We documented instances of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against civilians in Kachin State. As I said, we put out this report in June 2014, and we documented how Myanmar state security forces systematically tortured civilians in Kachin State, in rural villages, in areas of armed conflict, in government facilities, and in places of detention where people were held incommunicado. At that time, we said that the crimes that we had documented may constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity, and we called for an investigation into those crimes to hold perpetrators accountable. To this day, Myanmar authorities have absolutely failed to do that, and perpetrators of those crimes continue to walk free. Alongside that, in Northern Shan State, where conflict has really spiked since October of 2015, but has been going on for much longer, as many of you know, we've seen similar crimes being visited on civilians there. So if my technical abilities will allow, I'd like to play a short video. Let's see if we can do this. Thank you. So this footage surfaced on Facebook in May of 2017. Shortly afterwards, in investigating some of the material that we saw in that short film, we commented on it publicly, put out that short film, and pushed for accountability. Subsequently, the Ta'ang National Liberation Army, an area under their control is where that video was filmed, weighed in and said that footage was from 2015, from June 2015. Nonetheless, we publicly stated, along with many other civil society organizations, that Myanmar authorities should hold perpetrators accountable and ensure that violations like that couldn't happen again. A few days afterwards, the Myanmar military commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, along with state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, both publicly stated that an investigation would take place and the perpetrators seen in that footage would be brought to account. To this day, we've seen no investigation. All of those perpetrators continue to walk free, and the whereabouts and well-being of those men is still unknown. Meanwhile, in Kachin State, at the tail end of 2016, a wave of attacks by the Myanmar military on Kachin Independence Army border posts in Gidon and other places in the north of Kachin State pushed thousands of people to flee IDP camps and their villages in surrounding areas. Many thousands fled to the China border, where Chinese security forces pushed IDPs back, essentially forcing them into makeshift IDP camps. One IDP camp in particular named Shea Yang, which was hastily established by a number of Kachin civil society humanitarian groups doing everything they could to protect people fleeing these abuses. Alongside that, in areas under government control, skirmishes between the Myanmar military and the Kachin Independence Army have continued to displace people, have continued to kill people, have continued to injure people, and make life generally unlivable for displaced populations in Kachin State there as well. In June of this year, more than 1,000 people from Kazung in Mogang Township in Kachin State were displaced by this fighting. In the aftermath of that, Myanmar authorities refused to build IDP camps to house people that have fled this conflict, instead forcing them into churches, town halls, and other facilities run by mostly faith-based organizations. Those people remain displaced, and they remain in desperate need of food, healthcare, shelter, and many of the other things that constitute the basic standards for any displaced person across the world. That's a bit of scene setting for what I want to go on and talk about now, which is the situation for IDPs in areas under the control of the Kachin Independence Army. I think the key message that I want to communicate here is that the world's gaze is quite rightly fixed on Rakhine State at the moment, and the horrors that are being visited on Rohingya Muslims and other communities in Rakhine. I think many of us will understand why that is the case, and I understand from my parents that there's been a lot of coverage on the news here for the situation there. At the same moment, while people's attention has been focused there, the war in northern Myanmar continues, and people continue to be killed and tortured and displaced as the fighting goes on. And groups have been forced to respond.
Thank you.
So across Kachin State and Northern Shan State, at the moment there are an estimated 100,000 internally displaced persons. In Kachin, around 40,000 of that number are in areas under the control of the Kachin Independence Army. That map from this far away doesn't show it very clearly, but the camps right on the border with China, the little triangles that are red colored are camps under the control of the Kachin Independence Army, rather than the blue that are in government control areas. So several years ago, the Kachin Independence Organization and Kachin Independence Council were designated as an unlawful association by the government of Myanmar. In one fell swoop, they became illegal. And under that piece of legislation, anyone that associates with the KIA or KIO in any way is deemed to be working with that organization and can be prosecuted for that. We'll talk a little bit later about some of the cases that we've worked on where people have been targeted for that association. The reason for mentioning that is that one result of this designation is that for journalists, for human rights activists, for human rights defenders, and for humanitarian groups, getting into areas under the control of the Kachin Independence Army has become more and more difficult as restrictions have grown. And many of those restrictions stem from the designation of the KIO and KIA as an unlawful association. In terms of justifications for the restrictions, Myanmar state security forces have been pretty consistent in saying that this group is an insurgent group, that the Myanmar state security forces are not in control of their security. They can't guarantee the security of anyone visiting those areas, so they will not grant people access. What that means is that people have to find other ways in, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. The key point that I want to make here is that the impact for internally displaced people in areas under the control of the KIA is massive. As long as people are unable to get in and deliver food, healthcare, and other basic materials for survival, staying alive becomes extremely difficult. So this is a shot of a camp called Shi'it Yang, which was established in the wake of the attacks in northern Kachin State, particularly Gidon, Kaohsiung, and some areas surrounding in northern Kachin at the tail end of last year. As I said, the camp was hastily established by Kachin humanitarian groups using basically whatever they had to keep people protected from freezing cold temperatures at these altitudes, and provide them with whatever food they could. In this camp, conditions are some of the most extreme of any camp in Kachin State. Geographically, it's very, very isolated. It's extremely difficult to get any kind of materials in. But this camp is not alone. The conditions in this camp are not singular, and there are many commonalities with camps across the rest of Kachin State, particularly areas under KIA control. So just for a moment, I'd like to talk about some of those conditions to give a sense of the way that IDPs are living. So the last time that Fortify Rights visited those camps, people were pretty consistent in three or four things that they told us about what it's like living there. People said that they didn't have enough food. They said that the rations that they get supplied are rice, salt, and cooking oil, and nothing else. Sometimes sporadic, irregular missions from INGOs or UN, or people that have been supplied with materials by INGOs or the UN will provide pulses, beans, and things like that. But that kind of food is very irregular, and getting access to that kind of food is very, very difficult. People talk to us about healthcare and the near total absence of healthcare in camps under the control of the KIA and more broadly in Kachin State. People told us that access to primary healthcare is pretty limited, let alone anything that requires more complex medical procedures. People told us that while there are clinics as a first point of call in many of the IDP camps, those clinics lack basic medicine. Oftentimes they lack personnel with the training necessary to diagnose and then treat illness. And the process of moving from a camp clinic in a remote camp to a place that has a hospital, which will probably be Liza or Mai Jiang, is an expensive process. It's a complex referral process, and it takes time. Many people suffer enormously, and many people perish because of that. The other thing people told us is that the shelters in their camps have not been repaired or renovated for 3, 4, 5, even 6 years. They were built as temporary shelters in the first place. Most of them are made out of plywood, some of them sheet metal, some of them tarpaulin. Getting basic access, getting basic materials for shelter, rather, into camps like this is extremely difficult, because getting materials like wood, metals, and so on through very vigilant state security forces is much more difficult in many cases than getting the occasional bag of rice through. People have been living in the same shelters for 6+ years in some cases, and they weren't built to be there for more than a year when they were established in 2011. Other things like non-food items, things like blankets, things like sheets for beds, basic things that keep people warm in freezing cold temperatures in winter, have been completely lacking. UNHCR have told us and have published data saying that across vast swathes of Kachin State, people have not had deliveries of these kinds of materials for a very long time. What's consistent across all of these camps is that people's basic dignity, the standards that we require for basic human dignity, are not being met. The situation is not going away. In fact, the situation is worsening. I think the key reason for that, one of the key reasons for that, is Myanmar state security forces' restrictions on humanitarian groups trying to get these basics to IDPs in Kachin State. And that's what I want to talk a little bit more about now. So this photo is of a guy called Stephen O'Brien, who I think at the time was the head of the UN OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. I think he was the head of global operations for UN OCHA at the time. He managed to get into KIA-controlled areas for a day with his staff to visit some camps in and around Liza. He was pretty unequivocal about what he saw in those camps in the aftermath of his visit. And what he said corroborated the findings of humanitarian groups, human rights groups, civil society organizations that have been speaking out about the situation in Kachin State for many years. The fact is that since 2011, access for the UN and for the international NGOs and for other humanitarian groups to camps in areas under the control of the KIA has been limited at best, and right now is almost non-existent. Since April 2016, when Aung San Suu Kyi's government took office, those restrictions have become tighter. It's become more difficult for aid groups to get into these areas, and IDPs are suffering as a result. Aid groups, both international aid groups and Kachin aid groups, have told us that access to these camps is getting worse, not better, and that IDPs are suffering as a result. So, just momentarily, I'd like to talk a little bit about these restrictions and the kind of architecture of these restrictions. I'm going to try to spend not too long talking about this because it's kind of nuts and bolts stuff, but it's important to understand the rings that the government make humanitarian groups run around themselves to try and get food and healthcare and so on into these camps. So to be able to get access to camps in under the control not only of the KIA but the TNLA and other areas where conflict is ongoing, NGOs, the UN, humanitarian groups have to apply for something called a travel authorization. Without getting final approval of this travel authorization, you cannot go to these areas officially. So for people in the international community, oftentimes they simply won't go if they don't have those travel authorizations. And the process of getting one of those travel authorizations is deliberately opaque. It's designed to confuse, designed to frustrate, and ultimately it's designed to target IDPs. So, if you are an international NGO based out of Yangon with operations in Kachin State, the first thing you need to do is write up a plan and send that to NAPIDOR. You need to say which camps you're going to, exactly what you're going to do, how long you're going to be there for. You need to say when you're going to come back. You need to give the names and passports of people going on that trip. That information gets sent from Yangon to NAPIDOR. That gets sent to the line ministry that you work with, which could be the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Relief, Resettlement and Development. Once it's been approved there, it goes to the President's office for approval. If that approval is not obtained, your travel authorization process effectively finishes. If that approval is obtained and you have that approval from the union level, you use that approval to then make an application at the state level. which is a totally separate application. But without getting the union level approval first, you can't move on to make an application at the state level. And without an approved application at the state level, you can't go. So with the approved application from the union level, people write to the Kachin State Chief Minister, or the line ministry state level representative in Michina. If they approve it, the application goes to the Minister of Border and Security Affairs in Michina. If he approves it, finally it goes to the Northern Commander, the person who's responsible for the Myanmar military's operations in Kachin State, and in Northern Chan State, Northeastern Commander. If at any point someone says no, you can't go, or at least you can't go officially. To get a travel authorization, aid groups apply 4 to 6 weeks in advance. Many of them don't receive responses at all. It's not often that you get an official refusal and the government says, you're not going, we're not going to allow you to go. More often what happens is people receive no response at all. So there's a constant process of follow-up. There's a constant process of chasing authorities to understand where your application is at, what is going on, are there any details that need to be changed? And most often those calls aren't answered. As I said, the whole process is designed to confuse, to frustrate, and essentially to make it more and more difficult for aid to get in. The result of that is that many international groups rely almost entirely on Kachin humanitarian groups to put themselves on the line and find ways and means of getting rice, paracetamol, basic materials for shelter, blankets, and so on, into these areas. Up until now, that has been the key dynamic. International groups relying on a coalition of Kachin humanitarian groups called the Joint Strategy Team to get this aid into these areas. And they have to work around restrictions as well. If they're carrying too much rice in a truck, Burmese authorities will turn them back and say, you're not coming through. If they find a way to get into China with that much food, Chinese authorities will ask questions as well. Chinese authorities play a part in this, in as far as they've also been responsible for questioning. They've also been responsible for tightening up restrictions on humanitarian groups, trying to get aid into KIA-controlled areas from the China side, rather than trying to cross from the Burmese side. All of that is to say a simple thing, which is that it's getting more difficult to deliver aid to these areas at the moment when it's needed most. 6 years into a conflict where funding for aid groups is decreasing and many people in the world are looking at other problems going on, humanitarian aid is needed more than ever. And access for groups trying to deliver it is more restricted than at any point. Alongside avoidable deprivations in aid, there are other things that make it extremely difficult for IDPs to be living in these areas. While it's not individual to Kachin and Northern Shan State, the ongoing presence of landmines and unexploded ordnances makes freedom of movement very, very difficult for a number of IDPs and people living in, and other people living in these areas. IDPs also face serious restrictions on their freedom of movement, both from Burmese authorities and from Chinese authorities. So to get out of the area in which you're living, if you're in an IDP camp in KIA-controlled areas, is extremely difficult. It makes it almost impossible to eke out livelihoods, and it drives a dependence on aid. At the same time as that dependence on aid is being driven, authorities are making it more and more difficult for the aid to get in. In part because of these restrictions, it's more difficult for aid groups to demonstrate what they're doing in these areas. For the international community to say we're going and we're monitoring and we're seeing the impact of what we're doing, and so we need more funding to do it. If you can't get there, that's near impossible to do. What we've seen as a result of that is a massive plummet in the amount of money that international groups have obtained for that work. In 2014, the UN asked for $66 million for humanitarian operations in Kachin State. In 2017, that number had dropped to $38.1 million. At the same time, the number of IDPs over those years has not decreased. Needs are absolutely massive. One UN official told us that the situation for IDPs is a chronic, protracted situation. Most people in country know this. They know about the desperation that IDPs are facing, but nothing is being done. At the same time, as the situation is the situation for IDPs is getting more and more difficult, Myanmar state security forces have presided over an active campaign of targeting journalists, human rights defenders, human rights activists, and others to try and keep the situation in northern Myanmar as quiet as possible. What we've seen in recent months is exactly that targeting starting to bear fruit. We've seen a growing crackdown on human rights defenders, activists, and journalists trying to expose the abuses in northern Myanmar. So the two men in that film, Dumdor Nong Lat and Lang Jor Gam Seng, as the film mentioned, are two religious leaders in Kachin State. What they did was work with Myanmar media to document and expose an airstrike, an alleged airstrike, I should say, by the Myanmar military in northern Shan State last year. Pictures of that church that we saw were subsequently published, and the Myanmar authorities went after Dumdor Nong Lat and Lang Jor Gam Seng. Held them incommunicado, detained them, held them incommunicado for more than 2 weeks, and forced them to sign statements saying that they were colluding with the Kachin Independence Army and had supported them in a number of different ways. Alongside that, the gentleman on the left, Dumdor Nong Lat, during the fighting in northern Shan State, gave an interview with the Voice of America and said that the reason that people were fleeing the fighting in northern Shan State was because government airstrikes were bombing. On Friday of last week, Dumdor Nong Lat and Lang Jor Gam Seng were sentenced to 4 years and 3 months and 2 years and 3 months in jail, respectively, for colluding with the KIA, supporting the KIA, and for defaming the Myanmar military. This is a picture of some children in the Manal ground in Michina, holding signs to commemorate the resumption of the war in Kachin, the 6 year anniversary of the resumption of the war. The reason that picture's on the screen is because commemorative prayer services, commemorative ceremonies like this are held every year on June the 9th, the anniversary of the resumption of the war in Kachin. What we've seen in recent months is a targeting of people organizing these kinds of protests, organizing these kinds of public displays of peace, organizing these calls for the civil war to end. So in July, we saw the Pakhan Township Court convict two religious leaders under Article 19 of the Peaceful Assembly and Peaceful Procession Act for failing to provide direct notice to authorities that they were organizing an event like this. On June the 12th, we saw three Kachin activists plead guilty to a similar charge in Michina Township Court. On September 19th, in a case that's still ongoing, a gentleman named Dashai Norlon, who's the general secretary of Musha Zinlum, a Kachin civil society group, was charged for defamation under Section 500 of the Myanmar Penal Code, the same charge that the gentleman on the previous slide, Dumdor Nong Lat, was charged for. He was held responsible for overseeing the distribution of pamphlets at one of these ceremonies, saying that the Myanmar military had committed human rights abuses in Kachin State. His trial is ongoing. If he's convicted, he's facing up to 2 years in prison and a fine. Alongside that, journalists are being targeted for the reporting that they're doing of the conflicts in northern Shan State and Kachin State. This is a shot of Lawi Weng, A Nying, and Pyebon from the Irrawaddy and Democratic Voice of Burma, respectively. On the 28th of June, they were arrested for having visited a drug burning ceremony in an area under the control of the Ta'ang National Liberation Army. They, again, were detained, were denied access to lawyers, access to their families for several days before the uproar of the international community brought their case to light. The military plaintiff, Det Nang U, withdrew the charges on September the 1st, but the chilling effect on journalists and activists has lasted. And there's a good reason why. For people doing this work in Myanmar, they're given a choice between silence and a sentence. We're in a situation now where Myanmar authorities look intent on keeping abuses in the north under wraps. And many people from across these disciplines have told us that they worry that as abuses continue and the situation gets worse, these restrictions and this targeting of activists, rights defenders, and other people besides are going to allow these abuses to continue unchecked. So, to wrap up, I tried to think about ending this as a kind of where we're going next, but there's no good news in this presentation, to be honest with you. What we're looking at right now is obstacles for humanitarian groups trying to deliver aid to IDPs increasing. We're looking at a situation where it's more difficult for groups to demonstrate the impact of the work that they're doing on the ground. We're looking at a situation where that is driving cuts to funding for these groups doing the work. And the ultimate reality then is that the situation for internally displaced populations in Kachin State is getting worse. Alongside that, in parallel, the government of Myanmar has rejected a UN fact-finding mission that was mandated in March of this year to travel to Myanmar and investigate human rights violations by Myanmar state security forces to hold perpetrators to account. It's very clear that the authorities in Myanmar have no interest in ending these abuses, holding perpetrators to account, or making it easier for IDPs to live with safety and dignity. So, we're calling on all parties in northern Myanmar to end the conflict and to respond to the desires of the people that they claim to represent and bring peace. The government needs to ensure that all parties to the conflict are brought to the table to discuss peace without excluding some others. As long as they're excluded, sustainable peace in the country is unachievable. Alongside that, the TNLA, the KIA, the SSAN, all other groups that are fighting with the government, government security forces, and government security forces themselves, need to commit to ending the use of landmines in the country. In Northern Shan State and Kachin, I think together something like 80%, correct me if I'm wrong, I think something like 80% of the total number of landmines used in Myanmar are in those two states. They continue to kill and injure and maim people every single day. The use of those mines has to stop now, and the government should ratify the 1997 mine ban treaty to help do that. The government needs to put in place a comprehensive plan to ensure that IDPs can return in safety and security to their places of origin. They need to be clear that in cases where people have lost land and they've lost property, there's a compensation plan in place. Finally, the government needs to allow humanitarian access for groups that are delivering basic means of subsistence to IDPs. They need to allow groups in to do their work. And the international community needs to start talking about that more. The international community needs to stand up and say that these restrictions and these avoidable deprivations in aid are unacceptable. I worry that if that doesn't happen, then the situation in Kachin State will look to get worse rather than better. Thank you.
Actually, just today, my goal is to echo what David has been mentioning. We've been trying to tell the world what's really going on the ground. Rather than telling us, perhaps it's like getting tired, so someone really get there and talk, see there and do research and then see themselves and then come and talk to your own people. I think that's something special. So we much appreciate what you're doing there. Just saying. Saying that, it is very important, the situation right there. We are so much worried. Across the world, the Kachin community, not just in UK and not just in the, within the country. We are very much concerned about what's really happening in Kachin State and Northern Shan State. Largely the Kachin IDPs, but of course there are the Shans and the Aungs and other ethnic minorities down there as well. So we are very concerned, and we've been keep telling the world that the Kachin case is the symbolic of what's really going on in Burma for decades. It set the example that we were the party that we took initiate to have a ceasefire agreement over 17 years, and then what happened next? What you see now is actually worse than ever before. Before the ceasefire in 1994, then yes, we have the conflict is still going on, but then again, this kind of internal displays have never seen in our whole life. This massive internal displays, and the situation was so dire. And just the day before yesterday, then I was privileged to attend the Global Travelizer Award. One of our colleagues, as well as she's our relative, Ms. Bepi, was attended, and then she. Along with her, then what's her name? Monica. Many of my know about her works in Northern Ireland, and she did brilliantly. And she just recently visited to Kachin State, and she stated that even in her speech, I was quite surprised that she stated that in her whole life, the situation in Kachin State that she's seen, it was tremendously. The word that you use, I forgot, but it's tell me something that even like her, Monica, like her, she's been not only to Northern Ireland, but also the Colombia and Syria and other part of the world, but being to Kachin States, and then she see the dire situation in Kachin State, and she said at the horror that she never seen in her whole life, that scared me. Just to see, let you see the picture. So I'm not going further about the IDP situation. So that's where we really need to get on to be able to see that picture. Why this conflict has been this much going on? I think we need to see the picture of what's really about Burma itself. Yes, Burma is a beautiful country. Yes, Burma is a ethnic diversity. And the natural beauty at most that I love so much dearly. But my question still remains, all these years in all my life, we've been like familiar with this conflict, this fighting between one ethnic to another. How will that end? And to this extent that we've been like waiting for years and years to get peace and reconciliation in the country that we wanted to see so dearly since after independence, which never ceased. Then our question here today, in terms of the Kachin public. Yes, of course, years back, before 2015, then we can not only just us that the world can blame that this is a military rule, this is how cruel the military is and how dictatorship were run the countries and so on and so off. The stories go on, but why now this still happening? This is really scaring. Even in 2015 election, the Kachins were voted for NLD, hoping that we might able to see a little bit better than the previous horrendous government, the central government as a whole. Then we voted for our NLD party and they won even in the ethnic area, except for the Shan states. But then again, this war crime and crimes against humanity towards our peoples and other ethnic minority it's continued. And the government, whether they neglect to just look at it or are they working together? That's a big question for us, the Kachin people and other ethnic nationalities as well. Imagine your government is doing, you are hoping for the best. The civilians government that you think they would do for your own people for the better good. On their manifesto, it was exciting somehow, even though much of the policy that we don't agree on each other, but the manifesto itself, NLD was like saying to the world, that not only to the world but also to the people wherever she goes to, even to the Kachin state where she wanted to come to get the voted for her, and then she said peace and reconciliation would be the priority for the country, rule of law will be the priority for the country. Now what we see here, there is nothing we can talk about peace processes at all. One of the officials about this nationwide ceasefire, they were talking about the peace, this peace regard to the peace process. Even with the military-backed government, the process was a little bit going further, but now it's stalled. For me, I got lots of questions. I think not just me, I think that's lots of people in Burma as well. First thing, you should not forget about when nationwide ceasefire, what David was mentioned, that some of the parties they did assign. When you use nationwide ceasefire, that has to be include all parties. But it was only signed a few ethnic armed groups, but it still not include the large armed groups, party like the Kachin Independence Army and SSA, NOD, AA, all these big groups that still fighting is going on. And if you do not include these large parties in the ceasefire agreement, then what kind of nationwide ceasefire that you are looking for? That would be a question. As well as, would this civilians government has a willingness to do this peace process and reconciliation as they mentioned, do they really have that willingness? That's a big question. It is so much difficult for us to understand, because before that, yes, they didn't ask us to sign this nationwide ceasefire. Plus, now they are much more, make it difficult. Don't forget the fact that NCA was signed, initiated by the Kachin Independence Organization, KIA, in 2012-13. It was in Liza, where the Kachin International Organization was based. That summit, it was brought up the idea that unless there is no nationwide ceasefire, we can't go on. If we don't have the political dialogue with the government, then we can't go on to the national reconciliation. So that's where the KIO was initiated, to put all these armed groups together, and then we must do this together. And it was like partly allowed. Military-backed government was provided as well. So but then again, KIO, KIA was initially include the UNFC, United Nation Nationalities Federation. These groups, it's all trying to include all these armed groups together. Yeah. And even then, the current government doesn't want to speak with the UNFC. as well. So because these under the UNFC, then NCA signatory and non-signatory, those all are included. That's why they don't want to talk with UNFC. So now even the KIO position is much more difficult. For us, the Kachin is much more difficult. How are we going to get involved in this peace process, which we have been always reaching out to the government that without the political dialogue, without this proper dialogue, then we cannot go further. And which make the way that government is handling is much more difficult for KIA to involve in this peace process. Now that the Chinese government has been involved, and it was quite frustrated that outside the union, the other party has to initiate to be able to hold this peace negotiation process. That's how the peace process has been much more difficult than ever before. In terms of begging this Chinese authority to involve in the peace process, then of course there is a Wa arms groups has been very powerful. So if you don't want to see us to work with the UNFC, then if we go along with the Wa, then will you accept us? But then again, government deny both party. This is so frustrating. That's where our question becoming, well, do they really have the willingness to have these peace process, national reconciliation, for the sake of the people, not the party, not the armed groups, but for the sake of the peace process? Well, do you really wanted to have that willingness at all? That's a big question for us. And secondly, we see whether you wanted to see this process or not, then you see how restricted they become on these IDBs and international community itself. Even in 2013, just about end of the 14, then UN and other international NGOs are able to get to the PIA control area, but then again, not anymore after 2015. We really felt that under the military-backed government, then they use full cuts policy. But now it's more or less similar. This civilian government is doing the same, to restrict it, to be able not to connect it with each other. That's a worrisome for us as well. And thirdly, why these challenges are being maintained. And the most important thing that they announced in their manifesto was to change the constitution. The constitution that has been protect military institution forever in the country, which they said they're going to change it, but this civilian government has not been able to touch this constitution at all. So unless this constitution has will not change the country, however much you try to do your best, any way you can, but the country peace and reconciliation will be still a dream. But we still hope to have a better life. That's why I just wanted to tell the audience and also as well as to the world that what we wanted to see right now in the country would be unless the military existence in the land and the fightings continue, then there will be no hope to be able to have it even on the discussion. So we wanted to call, and we've been calling the military existence in the not only the Kachin land but also across the country has to be withdrawn. And secondly, please make your voice with us. You hear today what's been really going on. To your government, to your MP, to your government, every government need to get involved in this situation as well. So please make aware of this. Bummer is not just part of the country, it's something's going on, but also across the country. Not just our Kuching State. Yes, this at the moment is really tiresome, really was. But then again, other part of the countries are still going on as well. And do consider how you can support. That's what I would like to say, because like, you can't get through via international community, even in UNHCR or other UN bodies cannot go into the area. Then whoever's working in the local and NGOs, try to work with them. That's the only way that we can reach. These people's taking their life, the risks they are taking is like unbearable, but they took their risks and then they do for their own people. What I'm doing here, what I'm talking here, when I'm meeting you here is nothing compared with what they've been taking the risks out there.
Okay.
So please do support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, I'm sure you have many questions for both of the panelists. So I just want to make a couple of comments, really. I mean, what struck me from your presentation, David, apart from, you know, the ongoing horrors of what people are experiencing, is just, yes, there is a nuts and bolts of this. And actually to hear how the travel access works and so on, that's actually a really important thing for us to learn about and consider, because this is not just an abstract thing, it's a mechanism that is structured in place, and it's there and it's designed for particular purposes. So that's sometimes not discussed when we're talking about the bigger picture, and so it's really important that we understand that. And then for you, Atang, I mean, what comes across, you started at the beginning by saying that you're kind of just getting tired of talking about this.
Yes.
And, you know, that sense of utter frustration after having to say the same things to people again and again and again, and you're not being listened to, and then going through periods of change at the centre, but knowing that where your relatives are or where you are living, things are going in a very different trajectory, and just feeling like you're shouting at the wind, you know, that sense of frustration comes across, and that's really, really damaging, because I mean, as an academic, I'm really struggling myself at the moment to know how what's currently going on in Rakhine State, how that should force me to rethink my own position. You know, I think we can no longer sit back in our own position and just say, okay, I understand what I know and this is not challenging to me and my knowledge in any way. I think all of us have to rethink our positionality and how we engage with these hugely difficult, complex issues. And for a lot of the time that I've been working in Myanmar, it's been the case that nobody's been allowed to put anything together. You know, you should treat all of these issues as separate. It creates confusion if you put them together. You should treat them as isolated and distinct. And I have a gut feeling now this is not possible. You know, we have to find new ways of talking about and thinking about these issues so that we can describe a spectrum of experiences, but just saying that something is exceptional is no longer reasonable, I think. But I'm still working this through myself. I can't claim that I've got any answers. But one common thread, obviously, is about displaced people and what you've been describing so clearly. And when I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I was very involved in working in the West Bank in educational projects with Palestinian children. And this was just before the first Intifada, and I was working in a school and in Nablus. And the Intifada started about 2 months after I left. I was working as a, you know, during the summer there. And then you suddenly realise 20 years later, 30 years later, actually those children who were in the school and who were in the camps outside, they're now the people who they were throwing stones at the time. their situation hasn't changed, it's got worse, and they're still the people who are now engaged in other activities. When I was in the IDP camps on the Burma-China border last year, we again went into the school, and it was a little primary school, and it was just a converted wood storage house when there was all the timber timber trafficking that was going on. The KIO built a big storage house, and they used to keep their timber there. When that was closed down, they reconverted it, basically repurposed it to house IDPs. And then we went and saw the little primary school children in there, and suddenly there was this kind of realization, you know, actually these children, that we call them IDPs, and that gives a sense that they've just moved in. They'd been born there. That was their whole experience. They were 6 years old, they'd been born in the camps, they were struggling to get any education. If those issues are not resolved, just as if the issues are not resolved on the Western borders, these things don't go away. They just continue and go on and on and on. So I mean, this is my kind of response really to what you've said, and just how chronic, as you said, this situation is, and how you have to also be able to feel that you're not just shouting at the wind and you can get some response.
Mm-hmm.